This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, FAA knowledge testing. Is the new boss the same as the old boss?
And the Tamarack winglet crash finding has been reversed.
The Velis Electro gets the green light.
The Piper Rudder AD tarnishes the NPRM process, we say.
Finally, Heli Expo happened and lots of cool news, David.
Ian, are you ready to do some Hangar Talk?
Let's do it.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, sky back.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, our guest is Alex Barker. You were just out there talking to Alex, you and Alicia.
We did.
In Southern California. He runs Fly Compton, a really cool community outreach organization that brings kids to the airport and flies them.
And they had an outdoor class in a hangar. Alex Barker held all the kids' attention and they went flying afterwards. It was so cool. And we'll see and hear a little bit more about that later.
Okay, cool. So the news, let's start out with ETS, a company you've never heard of, purchasing PSI, a company probably you still haven't heard of.
True. We've heard of them both now, Ian.
Yeah. So PSI is the FAA's knowledge test contractor. So when you go in to take knowledge tests, you know, it used to be like CATS and LaserGrade if you're back in the old school, right?
Right.
So that's now PSI, the single owner of that contract. They have been acquired by ETS, which apparently is one of the world's largest, I guess, digital testing companies.
Right.
They're a nonprofit, which is interesting, but no indication yet as to what it's going to mean for knowledge testing.
Yeah, and for us, pilots and folks who are going to take either the private pilot exam, a sport pilot, an instrument, commercial, whatever, we're all going to have to run our written test through this company.
Mm-hmm.
The deal closed January 25th when ETS acquired PSI. So it's been about a month since that happened.
Yeah.
As we record this. I understand that ETS is the world's largest private educational measurement organization. Of course, that's what they say about themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that it didn't look like to me that they played in the aviation landscape. This to me looked like that they are really keen on a lot of other industries, but not so much in aviation. And this does open the door to aviation. They have a lot of experience in the paralegal department, folks who are seeking to use English as a second language, K-12 assessments, et cetera, et cetera. But aviation is quite specific, you know, and so this is a whole different league for them.
Yeah, that's true. I want to go off on a tangent just a little bit. Did you read, we had a story actually with our legal department. One of the panel attorneys wrote a story about a young pilot who was taking a knowledge test and had all of her certificates revoked as a result of this knowledge test. Did you read this story?
I might have missed that one, Ian.
Yeah.
Well, tell me more.
This is unbelievable. So this is a bit of a tangent, but does have to do with knowledge testing. So she was, by all accounts, a very conscientious pilot, did very well all the way up through her certificates and ratings. I think she was taking either the CFI written or the FOI written. And I can tell you the FOI written is probably the easiest written I've ever taken.
Okay.
CFI is not that hard, right? But this, by the time you're up to CFI, you know how to take a knowledge test, right?
Yep.
So apparently her dad was very sick in the hospital and she took her phone into the testing center.
Oh, that's a no-no. Yeah.
Just to make sure she didn't miss a call about her dad. Understandable. Not a great idea. The FAA found out they revoked every one of her certificates for doing that.
Did they think that she did that all along for every other certificate?
Nope.
Well, that's so weird. You know, I can see stopping the test with the proctor, stopping the test and saying, all right, you're coming back next Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know, to do this again or something like that. But I can't see revoking a certificate. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a revocable offense.
I agree. And the thing is, they didn't even try and prove that she used the phone to cheat. In fact, they're not even saying that she used the phone to cheat. They just said by the mere fact that the phone was in the room that she could have cheated with it, apparently, and therefore has to have all her certificates revoked. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is. And actually, since we're off on a tangent now, I do understand that if you are appealing something to the FAA, you know, it's not really like a regular appeals court.
The standing just stands.
Yeah. It's rare for that to get reversed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think the NTSB often. Yeah, I mean, it's like they often say, the FAA. They give them the benefit of the doubt, it seems like, right?
Yeah.
Just amazing stuff. I mean, I was appalled, honestly. It's like, you know, and the other thing that came to mind is, and you sort of touched on this, is like the testing centers, they're supposed to have proctors, right? I mean,
the reason
that they charge for these tests so much is not because of computer time or anything else. It's like it takes manpower to administer these things.
Right.
And haven't you always been asked, like before you walk into the room, they're like, okay, no cell phones, no da da da, right? Like they tell you the rules.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And in fact, I mean, back when I, you know, did my last, well, actually the last one I did was a seaplane for a seaplane rating, but right, there really weren't many questions. I don't think I did one for a seaplane rating.
No, you wouldn't have to do one.
It was, I said to fill out the IACRA.
Yeah.
But when I got my private pilot certificate, I remember to use an E6B, you could use an electronic E6B, but it had to only be
an E6B
electronic version.
Yeah.
You couldn't use it on, even at that time, it wasn't even an iPhone. The iPhone wasn't even invented. But,
right.
But nonetheless, you couldn't use your Palm Pilot or whatever heck it was that I had back then.
Yeah.
But that is interesting. Well, bringing it back full circle before we leave the topic. ETS and PSI, did you know that they deliver 50 million tests annually across more than 180 countries?
So obviously aviation is going to be a small part of that business, but
That's right.
So we'll be obviously kind of looking at that to see kind of what happens if pricing changes or
that's
service.
What I'd be keeping an eye on, pricing or availability or shutting down facilities or opening new facilities up.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times it is tricky to get that schedule.
Yep.
Absolutely.
All right. Hey, David. So Tamarack winglets. Now, this is not something that we've talked about very often. They have that active winglet system, which is basically
that
like a
Atlas system.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Atlas does stand for something.
Yeah. It's like almost like a longer, it's like an extension on the wing before it goes up to what we think of as a winglet with almost like a little aileron. I'm obviously, you know, greatly simplifying what happens here. But anyway. So you recall there was an accident with a Citation in 2018 where it was equipped with these Tamarack winglets.
Yep.
The NTSB basically came out and said, hey, that technology caused an uncommanded roll.
It did.
And
that's what they said back then.
Caused the accident. And of course, you know, that was a nail in the coffin of the company at the time. They had to go through bankruptcy. So the company appealed, which is something I didn't even know you could do to an NTSB ruling. And they just issued it and they won. The NTSB reversed their findings.
That is so bizarre. Now, so to get folks up to speed, ATLAS stands for Active Technology Load Alleviation Systems. And they are installed on Citation jets, but also you can put them on a King Air. And the whole outer board portion of the wing articulates.
Yeah.
So that's something to keep in mind. It's not, you know, it's a real unusual process. There are a lot of moving parts for this.
Yes.
And you're right, Ian. What had happened back then was the Citation went into an uncommanded roll, and the pilot couldn't recover from that. But what happened to reverse this was the finding that the pilot was distracted at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were alarm bells going off, and there's a procedure that Tamarack had put in place. If you experience a roll, this is what you do, A, B, and C, including slow down as part of the deal. It went unrecognized by the pilot. His attention was directed towards a checklist.
Mm.
And then also with communications with a controller, The lack of a visible horizon factored into this. Now, the pilot was audibly surprised and did not reduce engine power or deploy the speed brakes, which were in that supplemental pilot operating handbook. So that, I think those are the pillars that Tamarack was standing on when they asked the NTSB to take another look.
Yeah. So apparently the way this works is that when an investigation happens, of course, it's at the regional level. There are regional NTSB offices. They do the investigations, write the reports. But when it's appealed, it goes to the national level and a new investigator is assigned and looks at all the evidence. And that's what happened. They looked at it with fresh eyes and they didn't say... It's interesting. They were very careful with the language.
Right.
They didn't say that it wasn't the winglets, but they didn't say that it was the winglets, right?
Correct.
They just said there's not enough evidence to say one way or the other.
Yeah, and they did point to these factors that the pilot could have done to alleviate the situation. The other thing that Tamarack was adamant about was that they wanted investigators to take a look at some of the physical evidence. There were striation marks underneath the wing and bent pins and things like that. And so that was another bit of attention that Tamarack wanted investigators to take a look at. But nonetheless, there was more than just this one uncommanded roll event. I think there were a half dozen or so at that time.
Yeah, there were kind of around the world. That's right. Yeah, and that you should say. I mean, that's a good point. It did help to bring trouble to the company at that time. And we should say they emerged from bankruptcy. They're doing fine. They're still selling the technology. People love it. So yeah, all's well that ends well, I guess. But yeah, it's an incredible story. It's something I've never seen before.
That's right. We're going to move on to the Velis.
Yes, the Velis Electro.
The first stumbling point for me is, how do you pronounce the name of the airplane? Because
right.
It's spelled, it's Velis, right?
Yes,
but I thought it was virus for a while.
It was a virus.
Okay.
Yeah, or a virus. So this is a language issue, obviously, because in English, maybe it's different than what they intended it. But yes, so Textron had applied for an exemption to the regulations because, as I think we've talked about before, if it's an LSA, there are actually specific rules in there that talk about it being a reciprocating engine, which a motor and electric engines aren't, right?
No, right.
And so this is the first that we know of exemption that allows an electrically powered aircraft to be certified as, I don't know if it's the right word, accepted under the LSA standards.
And used for flight training, I think, is the
key. And used for flight training. So, yeah. And this...
Absolutely.
So, this is immediate. It's on the next, 300-plus airframes, I think?
Right. The exemption will be limited to 350 aircraft starting at serial number 150. And don't forget, Pipistrel is now owned by Textron.
Mm-hmm.
Textron bought that technology because they bought the company and brought it underneath the Textron fold.
Yep.
I can see some practical uses for this. You know, we've talked about this a few times, Ian. I do think that electric or electric hybrid technology could be helpful when you're learning pattern work.
Yeah, absolutely.
In and around the airport. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is, you know, the FAA has specific regulations on how much, quote unquote, fuel you need in reserve for VFR daylight operations, for nighttime operations, for IFR reserves. And how do you put a reserve on a battery power? It's not a liquid or a time thing. You know, it's like if you turn the heater on, does that reduce your battery power time?
Yeah, that's right. Well, and it's regenerative. So while you're doing, so you're exactly right. You can't say you have to land with 10%. Well, I mean, I guess you could, but it's like you know, when they're doing pattern work, obviously you're using power in the climb, using less power on like downwind. But then when you power back for like base and final, it actually, at a certain point, the prop regenerates and adds power
right
to the batteries. And so it's like, you know, that number is sort of, it's going down,
it goes up
ticking
and down.
Up, going down, ticking up, right? So yeah, you're right. It's an unusual situation for us.
So I highlighted a couple of things and we're reading from an article here that we saw in AvWeb. Number one, in my mind, you know, the exemption was allowing the use of electric motor as power. Like you said, that's part of the original rules and LSA rules. It didn't list electric motors as a power option. Number two, I was looking at this. The other exemption allows students and instructors to log time in the plane, in the airplane. So we did write a story a while back about a company out in California that had several electric trainers But the problem was that you couldn't really technically give training in the trainers. Well, now you can. And as you said earlier, the exemption will be limited to 350 aircraft, starting with serial number 150.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It is. It's very cool.
What's the endurance of a Velis Electro? Is it about an hour?
More or less an hour. Yeah.
So if you're going to do flight pattern work and say you do 30 minutes of work and you land, you would have your 30-minute reserve there on VFR daylight day.
Yeah. And I don't remember off the top of my head, but I do think you can go a little longer. I mean, it's like one of those, it might be like an hour 15 or something to totally empty. So you might be able to go like 45. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, I mean, you can be reasonably safe at a, you know, approaching an hour, I think, for a flight training sort of hop. So yeah, it's, and I think we need to remember, it's like a lot of people on AvWeb, a lot of the commenters are really just panning this thing. And I just think we have to remember, you know, we're at the beginning.
We are.
Right? I mean, we're still at the beginning of electric aviation. And I think this is an awesome first step. And it's selling reasonably well in Europe. They're using it in a variety of applications. And I think it's going to do well here in the States. And I think people are going to really like flying it and be drawn to the technology.
Well, another thing that we have talked about a little bit off and on, Ian, is the noise signature.
Yeah.
And when you live, when you live near an airport, or say you're even on the ground, like we were on the ground at Fly Compton, and we're going to talk to Alex Barker in a little bit, our guest. And there were some aircraft in the pattern, and they were pretty loud. It was pretty disruptive to the classroom, which was an outdoor classroom in a hangar. So folks who live near an airport might appreciate some of the quieter technology here. And to be honest, I'm on the side of the fence that says, let's keep good neighbors, you know, and we might need technology to work for us to keep good neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And we'll be right back. Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. Okay, David, I want to talk about something that is super important for you and I. And so I'm sorry, we're just going to talk about it every time there's an update because we're personally invested, but so are
31,000 other pilots. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the Piper Rudder AD. So the comment period recently closed. And as a result, comments from AOPA, EAA, and the Short Wing Piper Club were posted. And boy, the Short Wing Piper Club comments in particular just eviscerate this NPRM and come out very strongly in opposition. And I think they have a lot of good data to back it up.
Absolutely. And before we even get into the individual comments, let's just mention that there were more than 300 comments on this proposal, including some of the folks that we have had on the show and we've talked to. Sarah Rovner, who has a Piper Super Cub. She flies up in Alaska. I actually commented on it myself. AOPA commented, the EAA commented. I was surprised there were comments from the Royal Netherlands Air Force Historical Flight Group.
Yep.
They had a couple of tube and fabric Pipers in the hangar there. So, but you're right. The Short Wing Piper Club has been really like a bulldog on this proposed rulemaking process. And the issue, I think, one of the main issues, you and I were talking about this ahead of time, is that the ACS notification process seems to be broken to a degree. And our own Murray Hewling mentioned that in his comments on that from AOPA. At the time, I think when you have an incident, usually the type clubs get involved. And I noticed this when I had an air coupe type club got involved with this thing that ended up being called the Swiss cheese AD, where you did inspection holes to check out the spar under the wing. But the Short Wing Piper Club, the Super Cub groups, the Cub groups, didn't look like any of these groups that had specific type knowledge were involved in any kind of communication from the FAA in advance of this airworthiness concern.
Yeah.
And I think that that needs to change. That needs to get fixed like ASAP.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And so that's one of the issues. I think the other big issue here, I mean, if you could talk about, you know, the Short Wing Piper Club does a good job of, they sort of parse through sentence by sentence of this NPRM and go make a lot of good points. But if you could make sort of the overall argument, it is that it's too broad in scope, right?
Way too broad.
And then that there's no, I think, data to sort of back up what it is that they're looking at. There's no alternative methods of compliance, so it's just replacement.
Right.
And then AOPA and many others have said that the labor rate is way off, that $85 an hour just doesn't happen anymore.
No, $85 an hour is what the FAA proposed that to be. And it's really more like $125 an hour, even in rural areas, I might add.
Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting, the Short Wing Piper Club started out by saying, listen, you know, you have listened to an NPRM that you say was prompted by reports of a broken rudder. Well, the rudder did not break. The rudder actually was still functional. It was a rudder post. Now, there is a difference between a rudder and a rudder post.
Yep.
So the Short Wing Club really started out slamming, you know, this NPRM by the fact that, you know, saying, listen, stick to the facts.
Not even using the right terms.
And then replacing the entire rudder is a real invasive process, and there aren't as many folks that are up to speed on tube and fabric repair as there used to be in the past decades. And it's a very special process, and then you're introducing potentially more damage by cutting open the fabric on a rudder and replacing this post, where there might be an alternate methods of compliance, as you said, maybe shimming it up from the inside or something like that, or performing a stress test on the outside.
Yeah.
So didn't look like any of that was proposed.
Yeah.
And that's where there are some bigger problems.
Yeah. And even, I mean, even if you get down to the airplanes in question that were damaged, I mean, the FAA calls these accidents.
And whereas they were incidents, they were not accidents.
Yeah. They make the point that they think they're incidents. Well, apparently one of the rudders was taken from the trash.
Uh-huh.
So they don't even know, you know, there's no continuity of the part to know exactly when it happened and how it happened and where it happened and all that sort of thing, or even what happened to it after it was taken off the airplane. It also, apparently, all these airplanes were modified, which I do think we've talked about before.
Highly modified with a bigger engines.
Yeah.
In seaplane operations in Alaska.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a sweeping like PA-18, PA-22, PA-20. It was PA-12 and PA-14 aircraft, which are a little bit different design. And also, they were supposed to have sort of a keel underneath the fuselage of the airplane to help balance some of the loads that would hit the rudder.
Yes.
And from what we know, it's been posted that neither of these two airplanes had that installed, which means they were not in compliance with the STC to begin with.
Yeah, exactly right. And so would this even have happened with the, you know, had they been following the type design of the STC? We don't even know. Yeah.
Right.
So all sorts of problems here. I mean, I think we went back, there were, 320 comments, I think, roughly, total to the docket. We didn't go through all 320, but I can't imagine that any of them were positive. So next step is obviously the FAA is going to review all of these. They have to review all of these. It will take a long time for them to get through these. They will then have to address them, and all sorts of other things could happen in the meantime. They could look at these and say, okay, there are some good points here. We'll issue an amended NPRM.
Right.
They could just issue the AD and incorporate some of the comments. Again, they don't have to incorporate a lot of these. They'll just have to sort of address them in the comments of the AD. So, yeah.
I read somewhere, Ian, that it would take like 60 years to make as many rudders as you would need, you know, rudder post assemblies to replace 31,000 of them.
I know.
And they would come from one manufacturer. I mean, how do you even do that?
Yeah, it's never going to happen. Yeah, so. It is crazy, the whole thing. So we'll definitely talk about that again when it comes up, which no doubt it
I'm
will.
I'm sure we will talk about it again, no doubt.
All right, let's finish off on a good note, and that's Heli Expo. This is an awesome show. If you're a rotorcraft person, it's a cool place to go and geek out. This year, it was in Anaheim, and record attendance, we're being told, which is fantastic. And I think the top line news here is that there will be no more Heli Expos. They're changing the name of the organization. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Well, you know, we're just talking a little bit about electronic technology, Ian, and the wave of the future to be more exclusive to the ever-expanding electric and hybrid-powered, you know, vertical lift industry. HAI started out by saying that the organization will now be known as the Vertical Aviation International, VAI. And that is kind of neat. So it's sort of like embracing a lot of the eVTOLs that we've been talking about off and on for the last couple of years.
Yeah. And so Heli Expo, which is the trade show. So it's HAI's Heli Expo. That's what it's right. Been called. It's going to be called Verticon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I missed that. Okay,
which Verticon. I love.
Coming Verticon. To Dallas in 2025. Verticon. Yeah, yeah, I like it.
Very good. So lots of cool stuff that always goes on. No big time news. Robinson showed off its new empennage with the horizontal stabilizer. You know, the Hill Helicopter HX-50 was there. Chuck Chirac was there with Enstrom. I think the biggest news is that Kurt Robinson declared that he will be stepping down as CEO.
That's going to be the first time that a Robinson won't be running that company. You know, yeah. They just celebrated, what, the 50-year anniversary? We had a nice big story on that in AOPA Pilot Magazine. So that is big news, Ian. And what do you make of that? How do you think the trajectory of the company will change, or will it change? You're a big helicopter guy.
Well, so I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, David Smith is going to be the CEO. He was the VP of operations before. He's an engineer previously, I think, with Bell and maybe some others. It's all about the philosophy. So Frank had a very specific philosophy for the design of the helicopters.
Right.
It was to keep them as inexpensive as possible and as light as possible. So if Smith follows that philosophy, I think it'll be good, right?
Yep.
To have somebody who knows engineering, manufacturing, to be in charge. I mean, they are a mature company at this point, so I wouldn't see any sort of problems in the future. I mean, the issue is, does he believe in that philosophy? And I think, you know, he has worked for them already. This isn't from somebody from outside. Obviously, Kurt shares that philosophy as well, holds it very dear. So I think it only makes sense that they're not, you know, they're going to promote somebody with that same philosophy. So I think probably we're fine there, but it is time of big change, right? I mean, like you said, the first time a Robinson hasn't run that company. So you do have to sort of wonder those things, but I think Robinson owners and aficionados, I don't think they have too much to worry about.
Okay. Well, you know, a couple of things you mentioned right off the bat from this HAI Expo, you mentioned Hill Helicopters. You talked about the HX-50 just real briefly. That's a composite design. And then I understand from Nikki Britton, who covered it, that there was a constant stream of folks who were very curious about that aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really all of helicoptering, there's been a lot of, I would say there's been some good incremental changes here, but there have been a couple of new models that we should really make sure we keep, you know, on the forefront. And not only that, but some of the manufacturing is coming to the U.S. Airbus is going to build the H-145 in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. And that's a twin-engine light helicopter. Wow, that's a big bird, really. Twin-engine.
Yeah, it is. You know, they do. This is something I don't know if a lot of people realize, that a lot of foreign helicopter manufacturers produce helicopters. I mean, obviously, the U.S. is a major market. They produce helicopters in the U.S. So Leonardo produces up in Philly. And Airbus produces down in Mississippi. They produce a ton of H-125s, which a lot of people know as an A-Star.
Uh-huh.
And now it looks like they're going to do the 145 as well. And I think they do others. So yeah, there's a fair amount of foreign helicopter manufacturing that happens here in the U.S.
And speaking of technology and talking about manufacturing, Ian, one thing that piqued my interest was the Sikorsky Group. That HEX tilt wing demonstrator, that looks like a pretty interesting helicopter. That has some of the technology that we've talked about with tilt wing rotor design. But not only that, the power plant is going to be unique to that aircraft too. And we were just talking a little bit about electric and hybrid and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a hybrid electric demonstrator. And the prototype is going to be developed by GE Aerospace. And they're looking at future development across a wide range of aircraft.
Hmm.
I wonder how that's going to come about.
Yeah, that's cool. So it's like a turbine electric hybrid. That's pretty cool.
With a conventional tail and tricycle landing gear. It's like almost an airplane.
Yeah.
It is really. Yeah, tilt wing. I mean,
yeah,
you've seen the giant tilt wings that the military, flies.
Yeah, the Osprey, yeah.
They're huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
What else came out of HAI?
Yeah, I think, I mean, really, for our purposes, you know, we're just the light GA end. I mean, it's really, you know, to see Robinson there with a new design and Kurt, I mean, that was a big one. We should say that the small Sikorsky helicopters, you know, the Schweitzers now, back to being known as Schweitzers, they were there and they, I think, just got approval on their crash-resistant fuel tank. So that means they'll be able to sell in the U.S. So that's pretty cool.
Yep.
They're a relatively small operation and they've been focused on doing parts. So we'll see if that means they're going to produce some more helicopters. And then Enstrom obviously has been completely revitalized, which is a great story and you know, back U.S. owner and local investment. So they came out in full force. And so, yeah, it's good. And as we know from the Gamma Report, the sales are up kind of across the board. So it's things are looking pretty strong there, I think, in the Verticon area.
Verticon 2025 coming to Dallas.
Yeah, that's right. All right, David. So let's talk to Alex. So in fact, you were just out there in Robinson's neighborhood talking to Alex and learning more about Fly Compton with Alicia and the great stuff that that they're doing.
My name is Alex Barker, and we are at beautiful Compton Woodley Airport, Compton, California.
Great. So you are here with the Fly Compton Foundation, and what did you do for the foundation today?
I currently am the chief flight instructor, and I'm the director of training and standardization with the foundation here at Fly Compton. So really, I'm just making sure all the kids have something to chew on every week.
Is it hard to come up with the lesson plans?
Well, lesson plans, that's the thing with lesson plans, you know as much as I do, it's like these things have already been written a million times. We're just making it in our own way that's digestible for these kids. So yeah, we're gonna talk about pre-flight, we're gonna talk about, you know, engine start and all these things, but what can they maintain, what can they gather each lesson for as little as we have them? Like, we're just trying to get it into bite-sized pieces, right? So.
How long is each lesson on the weekends? Or the two, there are two lessons, and how long is each one?
Each lesson, yeah, we have two sessions, one for an older group and one for the younger group. The younger group is 8 to 14, and the older class is 14 to 18. And we will ramp up the intensity a little bit more for the older kids, because here's how it works. As the students ascend from the younger group and they have become more senior in this class, then they're eligible for our scholarships and our more focused training, like our solo camps and private pilot full-on training. So we do 1 hour each. So we'll do 1 hour of ground followed by a flight. And for the most part, we usually do a lap in the traffic pattern, maybe go out to the practice area a little bit, come back. But just to kind of get them in the mix a little bit, maybe connect some dots a little bit. I can't just talk to them about taxiing and then they're gonna know everything, right? So I have to talk about, okay, taxi. Focus on that. Okay, this one we're talking about radio communications. Let's focus on that. So how much can you really teach them in the airplane for 15 minutes? You know what I'm saying? So that's why we have to make it more digestible pieces like that, right?
So how did you get started in aviation?
My dad was an air traffic controller at Los Angeles, as long as I knew. As long as I knew, that's what his job was, and that's what I, okay, cool, this is fun. But I didn't know about GA so much. It would just be, we go to air shows and that sort of thing, but I didn't know it was as accessible as being at an airport like Compton Woodley. As I got older, you know, what do you want to do with your life? I was working all these random odd jobs, and then, you know, my dad brought it up, like, have you ever thought about getting in a career in aviation? Hearing about pilot shortages and all, you know, right? So I'm like, okay, let's try this out. And I fell in love with it again. Right? As a kid, I always thought it was cool, but I didn't know. I thought I had to be a military person to kind of.
That's exactly what I thought.
Really further myself. So it's kind of always been around me, but I didn't really realize the potential until I was far older than these kids, let's say.
Yeah, same. I definitely thought I had to be military. I didn't have anything like this. And so it was just kind of by luck that I got introduced to aviation too. So right, yeah, right. It was, I did not have this. So what's the future look like for you?
Actually, I start SkyWest in February. So I start my training for SkyWest there. Really what I'm hopeful for, and I think you're asking me, am I gonna be flying the kids? So I think that might be a little conflict in the future. So I think really I like doing the grounds, which is not normal for most CFIs. They just wanna get their flight time and whatnot. I like working with the kids. I'll do the ground stuff and then I'll pass on the flight responsibilities to the younger, hungrier CFIs that want to be building their time and that sort of thing. So that's kind of really what my role is here.
So you'll stay involved even at SkyWest, even when you're at SkyWest?
Absolutely. This is my baby. These are my babies. This is more important to me than flying passengers to, you know, Portland or whatever. Like, that's cool. That's always been what I wanted to do, but I didn't realize that this is something, a need that needs to be fulfilled. Really, when I was going through it, I had to pay out of pocket and all the things, you know, and I have a bunch of debt. Thought there was gotta be a better way than to pay for an instructor, you know, $100 an hour or whatever it is. It's cost prohibitive to all these kids and these families and stuff. So how can we get them involved in a reasonable, in a reasonable way? At least we're keeping them, their motivation, their interests. That's what I'm after. I'm after educational access.
Changing lives, introducing people to it. And it's like the, we were talking about with Demetrius and how like he saw African-American pilots and that's what inspired him to start. And it's like, I'm sure it's so helpful to the kids to see this path, knowing it's an option.
I'll be honest with you, that really wasn't on my radar until this new hiring wave has, it's been a buzz now in the whole, you know, conversation about who is getting awarded these opportunities. I did not even realize the statistics about minorities, women, minority women, right? Like, I didn't know. And then I started doing some research. I started, you know, getting deeper into the career. I'm like, oh, actually, this is kind of rare. And then I started meeting folks like Ronell and Demetrius and stuff. Like, oh, okay. I didn't know that there was clubs and, you know, social, you know, gatherings for women in aviation, Sisters of the Skies, OBAP. I had no idea about any of those different clubs and organizations and stuff. I get it, but it wasn't a... So I started doing this stuff without knowing that that was really what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not like we're closed to just black women, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not what we're doing here. I mean, it just happens to be that people would rather donate to our cause if we do serve those communities. Doesn't mean we're closed to it, but I just think that that's a very interesting place that we found ourselves in this time, you know? Like, this is what we have to do. We need to boast about that we're doing this? No, it doesn't matter to me. We're teaching everybody if they want to learn. That's really what I'm after. Educational access, who wouldn't normally have the access to it. That's what I care about, you know?
Right, yeah, that makes sense. You did a really good job of relating the complexity of air traffic control to everyday situation. I loved your example this morning of like your parents yelling at you to clean your room.
You got a little glimpse into my mind. How do I make things that the kids see every day? How do I make that relatable to what we're doing flying an airplane? A lot of people might not think that it's anything connected, right?
Yeah.
But these rules, and you know it now because you've studied all this stuff and you probably heard what I said, you're like, oh yeah, right? But these rules, the way that we do these things is because humans behave this way already, right? So teaching these kids, like, this is how we're doing it right now. Why do we talk like that? Why are we talking to them? Like, oh yeah, it's just like my mom yelling at me. They don't want to repeat themselves. You get what I'm saying? So there's a part of it where it's like, I used to be so nervous when I was doing this. And I used to, I wonder how this one's gonna go. I never was like, confident about it, you know, we'll see. And the more I do it, I see I get feedback from the kids and they're like, oh, good job, whatever. What I would do in the beginning to kind of gain more confidence, because I'm not used to doing like the group ground, it's more like individual, most of the flight instruction. When I was brand new, what I would do to gain more like kind of inspiration for how to talk to the groups, I would go watch a lot of stand-up comedy. And then I would see how these comics would be picking on people in the crowd. And it's huge to learn the kids' names. So once I learn the name and I can pick them out and I can say, hey, and call them out about something, where it's their something they're wearing or their mom told me something about them or whatever. And I call them out like, oh, now they're engaged. I got their attention. And all these other kids just saw what I did to that guy. They're now on their best behavior. And I'm like, oh, all right, I gotta, you know. So a little bit of like kind of stand up kind of routine in there, but also like I just try to make it relatable to their everyday. I'm trying to use vocabulary that they understand, that they will use on their day-to-day, right? So I try to break it down, language, and then what is their experience with life so far,
yeah.
You know?
Well, I think you're totally succeeding. We loved your lesson. It was so funny. I was laughing. Great job.
Thank you.
And yeah. It's not just because you guys are here. This is what we do. But whether you're here or not, I'm like on the way here, like, I hope this works. And I'm like, you know what I'm saying? I'm like trying jokes out, essentially, and then...
They're your test crowd?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. They're my little test audience here, so...
How do you feel when you see the students, you know, be engaged and be successful and start getting interested in aviation?
Simple answer, it's the best feeling to see that they're actually retaining, I'm connecting with them on a way, you know? Some of these kids I've known when they were like at my hip. Well, I'm watching these kids grow, and some of the things that I'm teaching them, I could see, and their parents are telling me that it's now improved their academic performance in school, their social lives, how they present themselves, how they take responsibility. Like those types of things, I feel like, wow, unfortunately, they would rather listen to me than their parents, but somehow I'm connecting to them in a way that they do want to listen to, and that's really like fulfilling to me. But the students that pass their check rides, now we have them helping us out. They've now increased their level of responsibility, especially with giving back to what we're doing here. So that part is like, okay, now I've taught those kids, they've ascended into a new role. I get to step back a little bit and I don't have to be as hands-on because now I've trained the next guy who's gonna train the next guy or girl. You get what I'm saying,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the system can is into its next cycle and it's doing it without you, which is what you want.
Exactly. I nurtured it to grow the roots or whatever, right? We all did, it wasn't just me. But we all, you know, and now it's self-sustaining. It's crazy, we started with one airplane and now you see the fleet that we have. And it wasn't because, you know, we're not shoveling out money. It's a lot of people are helping us, you know, donating and even donating planes. And so this has just been like, I think the community really sees what we're doing and we're getting a lot of support, you know? We bought one plane, that's how we started this and we proved the concept and that's how it started snowballing.
What was the first one?
That was the Piper Cherokee, which had the prop strike. It was a PA-28-140. It's in one of our hangars here. That's another thing, we had zero hangars, we were just working on the ramp. Now we have, the airport's been cool, we have like five different hangars we have access to, which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Right, so like, all I'm doing is I focus on teaching the kids. That's what my job is, to standardize the training and to, you know, be accountable for, you know, student success. That's what I'm up to.
Well, I think you're succeeding.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for talking to us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
These are cool stories because they really are labors of love, aren't they? I mean,
yes.
This is like, it's an immense amount of effort to make something like this happen.
And the students were so engaged in it. It really warms my heart to see the next generation of potential aviators want to go on a Saturday and attend classes at this airport. And they went on flights in GA aircraft and then Cessnas and Pipers.
That's awesome.
And the kids were just excited about it. So I definitely think it's the wave of the future.
All right, great. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangertalk and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we'll see you.
See you, Ian.
Hangertalk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.